Hello and welcome to The Week at Work. My name is Michelle Byrne and I'm here with my co-host Dave Gibney. And as always, we'll be having a look at the news from the week and what's been going on and the stories from a Left perspective. And The Week at Work, of course, is part of Left Bloc, a political education and media project. And you can find more information or support us on patreon.com/Left Bloc without the K. Dave, it's been good to have you back.
Cheers.
What have you been getting up to in the last week? What have you been looking at?
I suppose the stories again, and it, you know, since October, it has been the main story for most media outlets anyway. So we might as well stick to it too, because it's important that we don't take our eye off what's going on over in Palestine, in particular in Gaza. Although we're not forgetting what's going on in the West Bank as well. The entire issue of what's happening in Palestine should be front and center for any leftist anywhere in the world. You know, on Wednesday night, I think it was, I was speaking at an event from the TUI, the Teachers Union of Ireland, about what, you know, workers can do in terms of helping to put their shoulder to the wheel in terms of stopping what's going on. And what had recently come up, and I think we might have covered this a few weeks ago, but not in great detail, was that there's a gap in the 1990 Industrial Relations Act. And stop me, by the way, if I'm getting too technical about this stuff, because this tends to happen with me in particular, because I'm, as you know, a bit of a trade union nerd. So if I use jargon or anything like that, apologies to the listeners, but I'm sure Michelle as host is going to pull me up on this stuff. But the 1990 Industrial Relations Act was brought in, obviously, in 1990 to regulate how workers can picket. And we constantly hear about, you know, the brilliant strike that took place between 1984 and 1987, the Dunstores anti-apartheid strike. And we've had repeated calls since October and prior to that, whenever there's been incidents like 2014, you know, that workers should all cease the handling of goods from Israel, which is a very noble call and one I'd support myself if workers have the confidence and the ability to do so. But unfortunately, the 1990 Act, you know, introduced 3 years after that end of that Dunstores anti-apartheid strike, bans political strikes. Actually, it bans all types of strikes that fall outside of what's called a trades dispute. So one of the documents that was found by a friend of mine recently, which was a guide written by the Labour Court Chair, former Labour Court Chair Kevin Duffy, which was really being used as a sort of selling point to the trade union movement in terms of bringing in the 1990 Act at the time. And in it, there is a little bit of a gap that allows workers to not handle goods from countries that are doing X, Y, and Z, or, you know, effectively what it means is that you need to create your own trade dispute. And the only way you can do that, according to the guide by Kevin Duffy, is to insert a provision into your contract of employment that would allow you the right to not handle goods from countries, for instance, where the ICJ, the International Court of Justice, has stated that there is a plausible case that acts that violate the Genocide Convention have occurred. So, for instance, if a worker in a an employment like a Lidl or an Aldi or something didn't want to handle goods from a country and that was committing a genocide, we all know that there's currently only one major case where this has been ruled by the ICJ already, and that's Israel. If you wanted that, you could insert something into your contract of employment that states, for instance, employees of Lidl are not required to handle goods from countries where the ICJ has stated there is a plausible case that acts that violate the Genocide Convention have occurred. If that was to be put into your contract of employment, you would have the right to not handle those goods. If your employer, and this is the key point, if your employer refused to put that into your contract of employment and you got organized along with the rest of your workforce in there, and you all signed a petition requesting this change take place, formalized that through your trade union, and the employer still refuses, that could form the basis of a trade dispute, or as it's commonly known, a strike. You could go on strike for the right to not handle those goods on the basis that your employer won't put it into the contract of employment. So there's a couple of us from different unions that have been discussing this and the possibilities of engaging a campaign entitled what we were calling it was to make your workplace genocide free. So we're setting up a group called Trade Unionists Against Genocide. That's probably what the name of this is going to be. We're working on the concept of it. We're talking to solicitors about how we can produce a guideline, a document that people could work on. But it did come up. What was interesting to me was it came up there 2 weeks ago or last week that there was a debate in the Dáil about euthanasia. And the debate was around whether medical staff, with the introduction of new legislation that would enable workers to avail of euthanasia in Ireland, if they so wished, that medical staff are looking for the right to not participate in this. And we saw it again, you know, with the repeal campaign, when repeal was coming in, workers having the right to not participate in something that breached their conscience, so a conscientious clause. But particularly euthanasia was raised with me by a colleague of mine who said, you know, it's interesting that we're having this debate about, you know, a conscientious clause for medical staff who don't want to take the life of somebody who wants to die. Yet workers in retail and in the distributive trades and, you know, in all sorts of outlets are being forced to handle goods and don't want to participate in this in relation to, you know, somebody who, you know, thousands of people who don't want to die. So medical staff don't have to handle or participate in something that's going to end the life of someone who wants to die because they're in severe pain. But everyone else has to handle goods that are related to people, thousands of people being killed who don't want to die. So there is that sort of whole philosophical debate around, you know, why should I participate through my employment in this genocide and ethnic cleansing and apartheid and everything else that's going on over in Palestine? So we're trying to kickstart a campaign that would discuss some of this stuff among the trade within the trade union movement, because you will need to be in a union to be able to participate, because you can't go on strike if you're not a member of a trade union. That's recognized by the state. But it would also give the confidence to workers to get organized in their workforce to be able to demand that they don't have to handle these goods. So, you know, if listeners are listening to this and they have any ideas about it, because the original discussion that we had was, you know, a petition around the idea of the ICJ ruling. But there's a possibility that you could make it much broader, that if the UN has declared a country to be an apartheid state, that you wouldn't have to handle goods from that particular place. But also beyond that, not just on what type of goods or the sort of the trigger point around that, there's also, an expansion. So people working in offices won't have to work with Hewlett-Packard, who are identified under the BDS campaign as complicit in the illegal occupation over in Israel as well. So there's adaptability in this, and it's not like a one size fits all. People work in different industries that don't want to, you know, work with certain things and or handle certain goods. So if people have ideas, I'd be interested to hear some feedback on it. Yeah, so that's just one of the things I've been working on the last couple of weeks with a few other trade unionists, particularly from the Trade Union Left Forum.
Yeah, I find it really interesting, actually, even just that comparison you make with medical staff, because, like, you know, have other people drawn that comparison, and like, what is the difference there? You know, do like, because, you know, a lot of people were having that conversation around the workers' right to not, you know, carry out certain medical procedures. But, you know, why was that given credence in the same way, the same way that, you know, people were saying about staff in retail being able to do that? Is it because, you know, maybe there's more economic power? People were saying, like, oh, well, they've more economic power, so we'll listen to them more. Are they more unionized? You know, is that kind of like, oh, well, we'll listen to them more because that's a more unionized sector? Or is it like the whole idea of like, oh, well, I see a fruit in a supermarket and I don't see violence, you know, in the same way? It's like one step far removed, so people aren't making that kind of comparison. I just find it very interesting, especially since I've been recently involved in some BDS actions in shop stores, and like there's been a, you know, amongst our own branch anyway, there's been a big focus on making sure that the staff aren't being harassed in any of that action, that it's very much a statement to management that you go in and here's a letter and all of that, but also checking in on all the fruit and vegetables. And something that has been coming up as well is that now we're seeing a lot of the origins being hidden. You know, that, and this is like supposed to be, supposed to be on all produce. So I think that's very interesting. There's also new tactics being used where, certain produce is being funneled through another country before it gets to Ireland. So then that's been put on the produce as well. And another piece as well that I found interesting is like, oh, this was produced in the UK for Lidl, but it's an avocado. It's like guacamole or something. I'm like, yeah, but where'd you get your avocados from, eh? You didn't get them in the UK. Like, where'd you get them?
Scotland.
Do you know what I mean? Like, it definitely do not have the climate to be growing any avocados in. Do you know what I mean? So I do think there's now, you can see the pressure that's happening now, the economic pressure, because they're having to go through more loops to try and hide origins. But still, obviously, that means that we have to be more on our toes with it. But it'd be interesting to see how the staff, if they were unionized and, you know, willing to take industrial action on this, like, they'd have more access to information, maybe on the buying side of things, and maybe actually be able to equip us with more knowledge around how that's functioning. But maybe not. But it is interesting.
What is interesting that the parallels that you've just mentioned there with the Dun Stores anti-apartheid strike, because, you know, that strike lasted for 2 years and 9 months. And there's a misconception that the Irish government went and banned goods from entering Ireland from South Africa. They didn't. They banned goods from countries which availed of prison labor. And South Africa was availing of prison labor at the time. So that's why I mentioned a trigger to change your contract of employment. So in 1987, Rory Quinn, who was the Minister for Enterprise, Trade and Employment at the time, he banned goods entering Ireland from states which availed of prison labor. And that effectively banned goods from South Africa. So it wasn't a case that he came in and put in legislation to say, that you know, we're not having any goods from South Africa anymore, and we need something similar here. The problem we have is, and because this could be done, you could give people individual protection through the Dáil, like Article 1 of the Genocide Convention, and Ireland is a signatory to it. It states the contracting parties confirm that genocide, whether committed in time of peace or in time of war, is a crime under international law which they undertake to prevent and to punish. So, by rights, a government like Ireland should be banning goods itself, because we can't participate in this genocide that's been deemed plausible by the ICJ, right? But I have no faith in the political establishment that they would bring in a piece of legislation that will ban goods from countries that were committing genocides, right? Although they were fine with bringing in sanctions against Russia, even though, you know, the ICJ didn't go anywhere near close to what has been said about Israel. But that you know, we would like to see TDs at the very least on the opposition benches trying to bring in something that would ensure that Ireland's, you know, signature on that genocide convention is upheld. But in the absence of that, workers can do it themselves by getting themselves organized in large groups. Like, if the government did it and brought it in, and a worker didn't have to handle goods from those particular country. Then people could make this decision on an individual basis. But right now, if a worker refuses to handle goods from Israel, they can be sacked and there's no unfair dismissal. There's no recourse. You cannot win and you can't go on strike for an individual case like that. That was the purpose of the 1990 Act, to make sure that the Dun Stores anti-apartheid strike never happened again. But the second parallel here that's really interesting is just in relation to the relabeling of goods. In order to try and get the Dun's anti-apartheid strikers off the picket lines, the Irish government, and, well, in particular Dun Stores, I think it was, and I need to clarify this, but it was Dun Stores and other employers, I believe, they started sending their fruit to Italy to be labelled in Italy and then come over. So the Dun's strikers had said, okay, we'll come off the picket lines because you've agreed not to bring them in from South Africa. But when they realised they were being hoodwinked, they went back out and stood on the picket line again. So it's interesting. They always learn, don't they? They're so adaptable, these employers and countries, to avoid any sort of accountability for their own actions. But I think it could be powerful, because I think if we could get something done in a major employer in Ireland, I think it could spread not just across Ireland but across Europe and across the world, because we see it every day or every week. You know, protests all across the world around this stuff, but workers don't have the entitlements unless they change their contracts of employment. Like, we cannot do what I and what other people have been calling for, you know, and looking for and would support, because and you know, if I worked in a Tesco tomorrow, or in a Dunn Stores or whatever, and I refused to do it, I would be victimized for it. And there's nothing I could do about it because of the 1990 Act. So yeah, it would be great to see something happening on this front and workers taking the initiative themselves.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see how that would apply to other workers who are not just handling produce. Like, for example, AXA has been called out quite a bit recently around its links to investment in Israeli banks. More recently, we've seen quite a few more actions around AXA, but to the point where now in a couple of places, both in Waterford and I think it was... there was somewhere else, Dublin or Wexford, but they basically must have a line now where if you know there's a protest turning up, like lock the doors, like putting up pull-up banners in front of the doors, locking the doors, saying they're gone away on training, so you can't even have a conversation, but and won't respond to any of the correspondence that has been put in. So yeah, it'd be interesting to see how it would apply in that case as well, you know, where it's not necessarily like produce that you're refusing to handle, but potentially what it would look like, what mechanisms it would look like internally when you're dealing with the likes of kind of like AXA and the AXA staff and how they would handle that.
But it's the same thing I was saying. I was talking to somebody in the IPSC the other day about this. Like, the Norwegian unions ran a really successful campaign to stop the civil service over there from using Hewlett Packard, and it was successful. They got rid of all their Hewlett Packard equipment and replaced them. And that's something that office staff could do as well, and start demanding that, you know, if you have a company car or whatever it is, that your employer stops using AXA as the insurance company until such time as they divest from Israel. And same with Siemens. And there's a, for our listeners, there's a great website or web page on the IPSC's website, the Ireland-Palestine Solidarity Campaign's website. Under the campaign section, there's a boycott Israeli goods and services section that gives you a full it gives you a comprehensive guide to what you can take action against, including, you know, if the barcode starts with 729, don't buy the product that's coming from Israel. I know they brought in new guides or new numbers around that as well, but like, you know, it goes right down as far as if you're doing your family history, don't use My Heritage, because I came across that one myself, My Heritage instead of ancestry.com. you don't want to be complicit in anything that's going on over there. The other thing as well, by the way, about the produce element of it is, if we stop, if the world, or even if Ireland makes a start on stopping taking in goods from, and I mean produce specifically, like as you mentioned, avocados, potatoes. Like, I still find it very bizarre that Ireland is importing potatoes from Israel. Like, but if we stopped all that, it would stop the demand for expansion of land and the occupation of lands, and the, you know, what we've seen over the last 40, 50, 60 years over there, you know. So it might take a little bit of the sting out of that, maybe not huge, not completely, but at least it would, you know, make it less profitable for these settlers to come in and take land off Palestinian people who've lived on that land for hundreds of years, like the families have lived on it for hundreds of years. So sticking though with the Palestinian thing, you know, there's been a couple of things, and I know you've seen some of it as well, about this festival over in the United States, the SXSW1. And I will start off with that because I wanted to get into the arts, because, you know, while our politicians, not just across the, you know, Ireland, but across the entire West, have been, you know, complicit in allowing this to go ahead. And, you know, they have all these watery words or condemnation against what's happening, you know, 6 months too late. But like, the arts has been tremendous in Ireland in their showing their support for Palestine. And we saw during the week, you know, NECAP, I think, were the first ones that I came across as refusing to participate in this festival over in Texas because of its association with military manufacturing. You know, 80% of all the bombs being dropped by Israel in Gaza are coming from the United States, from these companies. But they're sponsoring
art. Not just association, like outright funded, one of the main sponsorships are coming from the US Army, like clear as day, logos up there, happy to promote this as if that's normal behavior, absolute abnormal behavior. And also other weapon companies, and also it has open CIA involvement. That's open. Like, CIA having a stall here, casual. What? Like, absolutely not. America is just so weird. Yeah. But yeah, like, of course, like that to us seems extremely abnormal. I guess from
can you imagine that in Russia? Imagine if that was the case in Russia or in China or anywhere else in the world where, you know, oh, the KGB are organizing a festival there, an arts festival, and, you know, there's an Irish band going over and playing in it, and, you know, the Irish band would never get a gig anywhere else again.
The media from that now.
Be hilarious. But, yeah, there was a couple of, you mentioned them just before we came on air, a couple of bands.
So Soda Blonde have recently been, were actually on TV with it recently, but also you have Gavin James, Mick Flannery, obviously you've named Kneecap as well, The Sprints, Robert Grace, there's quite a few people there as well. But basically all of the Irish artists cancelled from that festival, including, I think, two in the north. But yet we still had the Minister for Arts and Culture rocking up to speak at this festival with not one Irish other artist represented there. They'd all boycotted, called for her to boycott as well, completely ignored that. But as did Michelle O'Neill from Sinn Féin, who also spoke at the festival, which I think is not getting maybe as much coverage. But that is concerning, you know, when
Why was Michelle O'Neill there? Just the Irish connections.
Stuff. I think there was a few diplomatic things going on, but I think there was like a Northern Irish contingent as well as the Irish contingent. I'm not really sure how they worked that or whatever, but yeah, I had read that she was there too.
That's very disappointing, but that the entire arts community disses it and misses it, and then you get the politicians going over. It's symbolic of what's happened, I suppose, is that, you know, all politicians will come out and say we can't boycott this. Diplomacy takes precedent and all the rest. And the same arguments in 1960s, 70s, 80s about apartheid South Africa. We can't make this, you know, we Thatcher, big friend of the apartheid regime, you know, and then the other side would be the same. And then, it's disappointing to see.
Yeah, but this diplomacy comes at the cost. Like, you know, they can say all they like, oh, I'm going to go over there and say a few stern words, and, you know, that's going to be more stronger. But that argument is not valid. Our own other co-host, Claire O'Connor, pointed out online that Michelle O'Neill used really weak language, you know, the situation in the Middle East. So we're not even saying Palestine anymore. We're not saying genocide. We're not saying, you know, the situation in the Middle East. So this is the new weak language that both Michelle O'Neill and Leo Varadkar are using while they're over in the US. And actually, interesting enough, it was pointed out that Leo Varadkar used different language in two different areas. So in Boston, he said, I think he might have said ceasefire. He might have said something real, really radical. But then in Washington, D.C., he said the situation in the Middle East. The closer he got to Biden, the weaker the language became. But he did the Boston piece first. So my theory is that he wanted a nice little clip that could go back home to RTE to be played and say, oh, look, he's telling those Americans, telling the US empire where to stick it. And then he goes closer to Washington. At that point, the news is already out. So he can say, oh, the situation in the Middle East is complicated, and whatever he wants to say there, much weaker language. Not the hard talking to that we were told we were going to get, but like it is interesting about the Sinn Féin links as well, obviously, in this. Like, we saw I think during the week, Action for Palestine actually picketing the Sinn Féin offices in Dublin because of their refusal to boycott the White House. So, you know, people aren't just, you know, obviously rightly targeting the government, but obviously saying that the opposition isn't doing enough either when it comes to this. But at the same week, you know, what Sinn Féin are doing, some diplomacy over in the US at the moment, and openly saying, you know, Northern Ireland, like Michelle was saying, you know, we're Northern Ireland is open for business now. We have a government. Come and invest all your US dollars here. Get us back on track. Wow. Like, the messaging. But like, you know, you have to wonder though as well, like, particularly with elections looming in the South as well, like, what they're really going to gain. So like, yeah, they're going to gain what money, funding and investors, but they're going to lose so much votes by the time the elections come around that they're going to be putting their own votes in jeopardy. Because I think now more than ever, people are more clued in to the US empire and the impact it has both internationally, and I think people are not willing to stand over and allow that to happen. People are more politically educated on this, which is great, and they're going to use their vote, and Sinn Féin's going to feel the impact of that.
There's a couple of things on that. Like, so, you know, Sinn Féin are going over there, and they're probably thinking to themselves, so is every other political party, you know, that's a threat to them. Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, a lot of them will go and they don't, there's no qualms about it. So, but the difference for Sinn Féin is that, you know, their voting base is always, you know, the base, I mean, the solid base that Sinn Féin would have would always have supported Palestine through period. And we've never seen a genocide that, like this. We've seen attacks over there in 2014, 2010, I think it was. But we haven't seen anything like this where, you know, 17,000 children or so have been massacred. And there's no other nice way of putting it. But we've never seen also the American support for 6 months of bombardment and starvation and all the rest that's been going on. Bernadette Michalski referenced it, I think, at either the demo or at one of the public events she spoke at, because, you know, there's this thing of, oh, they're going over there to be seen, the Irish politicians going over there to be seen with Biden, and this is fantastic for Ireland, the image and all the rest of it. But she was pointing out that this is a reciprocal visit. So Biden uses this as sitting president to try and get the 42 million or so Irish people who say they're Irish, you know, descendants of Ireland, to get the votes there. And we shouldn't be giving them that ammunition to go to the Irish community and say, right, give me your vote, and you know, in Boston or wherever else. It would have sent a strong statement that, look, this is the first time ever that you know, the Irish politicians have said, no, we won't. You have to stop this, your support for the genocide, and before we'll come over and visit you again. But it's disappointing. It's not surprising to many of us as well to see, you know, politicians just go, do you know what? It's more important that I'm over there. I mean, the best article on this stuff, and again, it's coming back to the arts, and I think you might have read it as well, is Sally Rooney's piece in the Irish Times today. You know, she's given a very balanced, but, and I say balanced, like, it's obviously, to me, it's balanced. I would have went further, but it is very balanced, and there's nothing you could hold up in it and say that this is wrong. Like, she opens it up with a quote from Leo Varadkar: "The cries of the innocent will haunt us forever if we stay silent." And I'm like, what does he qualify as silent? Like, the cries of the innocent will haunt him forever because he hasn't, you know, taken any actions that he could have taken in the European Union, seeking, you know, the Israel to be removed from, not just diplomatic ties, but, you know, trade agreements. Let's end all trade agreements with Israel until this stops, or end them permanently. But, like, the article is fantastic. It goes through all of this around the visit. It has videos in it as well of Riker shaking hands with Biden and all the rest of it. But it's actually saying, you know, why do we have a problem with Israel? And he's got all these strong words against Israel, rightly so. But how can you shake the hand of the country that's facilitating all of this? Like, you know, the leader of the country that's facilitating this. The US supplies 80% of Israel's weapons, as well as billions of dollars in aid. But yet Ireland is treating it as a kind of a neutral third party. And of course, in quotes, she has a very good friend. Like, why are we good friends with genociders? Like, that's not rhetoric. This is evidential. They are still supplying, despite the ICJ's ruling, they're still supplying Israel with the weapons to genocide children. And we're shaking hands with them and saying, oh, they're very good friends. They've never been a good friend to Ireland. America only wants to be a good friend with Ireland so that it can keep, because of our low corporation tax and how we facilitate for the big businesses over there and all the rest of it. They don't give a shit about Irish people. They don't care about our exploitation at all. And Biden classifying himself, you know, and I think, I'm not sure if I saw this in Sally Rooney's one or where I saw it, but, you know, the famine that's going on right now over in Gaza, Biden's family went to America because of a famine here. So you think he'd have a little bit more ethics around this stuff and understanding around this stuff because of his own family history. But of course,
does he view that as, like, you know, a completely natural causing famine, or does he actually know where the blame for that famine came from, which is obviously the British Empire? But, like, you know, is that analysis there? Because actually, quite disappointingly, obviously, I was listening to an interview with Mary Robinson, obviously previous president, on RTE recently, and, like, she uses the term famine as well, but does not use the term genocide, apartheid, ethnic cleansing at all. In fact, she doesn't use any of that language. She says it's a dire humanitarian situation, the tension between Israel and Palestine, this famine, as if it's naturally occurring famine. Like, I just think when you're not actually blaming why the famine is occurring, then you're actually kind of whitewashing what is occurring. In the same way, obviously, you're saying, oh, well, Biden, you know, like, let's be real, the famine in Ireland was whitewashed as well, even from our own history. Do people, you know, a lot of people wouldn't attribute the famine. They'd be like, oh, the potatoes, the naturally occurring blight and all of that. And yeah, but why were we actually reliant on just potatoes? Like, you know, let's go a couple of steps back in that analysis. And I don't think everyone has that. So I do wonder, you know, is Biden just like, oh, you know, oh, his granddad or his great granddad or whatever. Does he have the analysis, or is just like, oh, just this thing happened and I had to move over here. Oh, you know, that's terrible.
He absolutely does have that analysis. He absolutely understands or understood what happened in the famine. But those people were his people, Irish white people. The people dying over in Gaza are not his people. And that's the big difference here. And there is this is about racism. And the world would not look at this in Israel or in Gaza the same if they were all white people who were being starved to death, children, white children being starved to death. It would be totally unacceptable. You know, and again, in Sally Rooney's piece, there's a piece there, you know, about the not understanding the full scale of what's going on over there. After all, this is a quote, after all, Israel has not permitted any external media organization to enter Gaza since last October, except under strict military escort. And yet, she goes on to say, Palestinian journalists inside the territory have been killed at a rate indicative of intentional targeting. In the whole of last year, 99 journalists worldwide were killed in the course of the reporting. 72 of those were Palestinian journalists killed by Israel. Like, that's a phenomenal amount. Do you know what I mean? That's two-thirds of all journalists in the world killed last year were killed in Palestine in the 3 months between October, at the end of the year, October, and, you know, January or at the end of December. And we all know, those of us on the left know, that this is deliberate targeting. They're going after journalists' houses. When they're in the houses, they're going after their families. They've been doing this for a long time. So history is not going to look kindly on the people who've sat there saying all these things. I think history will actually look back with more anger at the people who had the strong words but did nothing. So the likes of
even history, like, people are shouting about it now, you know, like, yeah. But obviously more needs to be done. And like, I totally agree what you were saying there about some of the stuff in Sally Rooney's article. I really like the line where she said, you know, our government can bask in the moral glow of condemning the bombers while preserving a cozy relationship with those supplying bombs, which I think really highlights that whole, oh, I'll speak up, but I won't do anything that you're saying about with like Leo and all of that. But actually interesting, you know, because we're talking about the role of Britain in some of this as well. I was reading a BBC piece, actually. It came up when I was having a little review this morning. And it was giving an analysis of Ireland, you know, in relation to Palestine. And it was interesting piece. It was calling out the fact that there was huge domestic pressure on Leo Varadkar before he went over to the White House. And then it pointed out as well, rightly so, Paul Murphy said that he sarcastically wrote Varadkar clearly really putting it to Biden if he felt able to agree with him. So I think that was a good point too. You know, if he's nodding along saying yeah, then, and I think as well, they're kind of saying two-state solution, but like, I don't know any Palestinians that are calling for a two-state solution. Then what, you know, so I keep hearing that from Varadkar. Mary Robinson said it as well in that piece that I listened to, but I'm not sure if any Palestinian organizations are actually calling for that. So just something to be aware of, you know, when we talk about ceasefire, talk about two-state solution, we're using this kind of like whitewashed idea of what, like, the Palestinian liberation are trying to achieve, like how to achieve Palestinian liberation. You know, why are we saying ceasefire? Why are we not saying like remove apartheid? Like, you know,
yeah,
I feel like we're coming into this language. It's like what the government do when around the housing crisis, they try to like change the language they use so it looks like it's radical, but actually it's not radical. They've actually just shifted the goalpost by using the same language. So yeah, I think that, like, that's a bit worrying to me now, because I'm seeing that happen quite a bit, obviously with ceasefire being the main one. you know, ceasefire is the absolute minimum of what we're asking for. That's not a radical ask. That's not even close to what's needed. It's just how the goalposts been shifted so far.
Yeah, and they co-opt it by saying temporary ceasefire, like for Ramadan or for 6 weeks ceasefire and all this stuff. And you're like, no, a ceasefire is a ceasefire. A ceasefire means the ceasing of hostilities completely. Like, it's not a temporary thing. So, you know, cynically,
I would say that temporary ceasefire during Ramadan is so that the US military can come in with all their construction to build the pier. Cynically, I was thinking, that's convenient timing that you would want it just for Ramadan when you're literally coming in and building this pier, which is one, probably to get the gas off the coast there. It's definitely not for humanitarian aid purposes. And it's probably to create a military base right in the center of it all. So, and access to trade routes, all of that. Not buying it at all. It's absolutely not humanitarian purposes, but also cynically think that temporary ceasefire thing for Ramadan is probably to do with them actually being able to travel even smoother through to get all their construction stuff in. And, you know, we talk about, you know, the targeting of journalists, but there's also now been the targeting of aid centers. So the UN report daily coordinates of where their aid centers are to the Israeli government, to everyone, so that they can be like, please, like, this is where we are, we're UN aid center here on the ground, like, please avoid, are now being deliberately targeted. I watched a horrendous video where they were like wiping blood off packets of nappies in the aid center. People are being killed in the aid centers because they're now being targeted as well. So they've kind of, you know, either murdered so many journalists and pushed so many journalists out of Gaza that now they're moving on to the aid providers. So this is, as you say, in the middle of an absolutely man-made famine because of the genocide that's been committed by Israel. But that's really concerning when you're talking about Ramadan and the importance of food in that practice as well. Like, it's just, it's disgusting.
Yeah. It's horrific. And, the humans behind it, like, allowing this thing. And, like, you mentioned about the two-state solution there, like, there's a reason people aren't talking about it in Palestine looking for a two-state solution. It's because they're not that naive to think that they're going to be allowed it. It's gone. It doesn't exist, and it's not going to exist. You know, what do they think is going to happen to Gaza now? You think everything's just going to go back to normal if there is a ceasefire of any kind, that the Palestinian people, the ones that are left alive or the ones that aren't maimed, that they're going to be able to flood back up to the north of Gaza? As if Israel isn't going to hold that land. Like, it's very naive. And the people who are saying it aren't naive. So they're just using that two-state solution as a means of sort of getting out of saying the real truth of what's happening here. It's ethnic cleansing. And they don't want to say it. And the two-state solution language gives them a cover for not saying this is ethnic cleansing.
Well, they keep expanding into Palestinian land. You know, what's this two-state solution look like? You have permission for this two-state solution because it seems like a reasonable middle ground or whatever. But actually what is happening is that second state that they're claiming, Israel, is expanding into Palestinian land the whole time. So what, you're saying, oh, that's okay. So you're kind of giving a bit of a free pass to them occupying more land, in my opinion. But
yeah. No, it's still all very depressing what's going on. And do we want to move on and talk about a few other stories? Unless you have anything else around Palestine.
No, just to say that, because I know we were talking about culture and stuff there as well, but there's obviously been the criminalization of activists in Ireland around supporting Palestine. Like, I'm hearing about Special Branch now being involved, targeting activists at peaceful, non-violent Palestine actions. More recently, Ono Kianavon, who is a PPP activist, he has come out and released a song, I think it was just yesterday, called Siren Spring. It's a very interesting song, very powerful lyric. So I would call to people to give it a listen, but also to purchase the song. All the proceeds, I think, are going to raise funds to cover the activist fees for the three who are being criminalized for their solidarity. So I just think that that's an important one to call out. So when we're talking about the people in the kind of culture sector taking action, I think that's a good one.
It is indeed, and the parallels with the Dunstores anti-apartheid strike continue. They were followed home at night by the special branch who sat on their walls outside of their houses, intimidated them and put pressure on them to drop it and call them silly girls, silly little girls and all sorts of things. So yeah, parallels continue. History repeats itself. You were looking at a couple of articles, I think, in the Business Post, Michelle.
Yeah, for my sins. I haven't read it in a while, so I said I better have a look. And, you know, it doesn't disappoint for the content of this podcast anyway. It was just something that I picked up as well, was like this use, and like, bear in mind the audience of the Business Post, right? It just like, it's not typically like workers. It would be more the people who have, like, you know, who have more of an interest in business, I would say, obviously. So one of the headlines that caught my eye was British activist investor takes stake in Irish REIT. And I was just like, oh my God, the use of the word activist in that title, like, actually drives me wrong. But British activists, because they're going to save us in the housing crisis, obviously. Again, going back to our history and all of that, don't think so. But yeah, essentially it's talking about this investor. I actually refuse to call them activist investors, because that just, again, co-opting a term that does not mean what you think it does in this context. So in this, because I was looking it up. So in this kind of area, from my understanding, is like the activist piece means that they're just going in to kind of disrupt the usual running, but not for the benefit of us, for the benefit of them. So, like, you know, it doesn't mean they're going to be like, oh, I'm an activist investor and I'm going to take on the biggest landlord in Ireland, Irish REIT. This is what the story is about. And, you know, they're not going to just like buy the whole thing up and, you know, hand it over to the state for public homes, which would actually make a difference. So sorry, lads, don't get your hopes up when you start read about activist investors. Activist investors just really means that they want to make change in the direction of a company, and they want to take over some of the boards so that they can take the profits instead of whoever the investors currently are. So yeah, they're definitely just acting in their own benefit and definitely not in the people. So apologies to anyone who's getting their hopes up with these activists with money. Don't know about that. But yeah, I just think it's interesting, because obviously Irish REIT is the biggest landlord in Ireland, and like, it would have come up a couple of times in CATU, the Community Action Tenants Union's work, a couple of years ago, when there was discussions around the CETA, and how, you know, the investor courts there would have caused big problems, because Irish REIT was mostly Canadian investor funded owned, and it was the Canadian trade agreement. So if this had gone through, they would have been able to sue the Irish government for any changes to housing policy legislation. So for example, if they put in like a rent cap, they'd be like, no, that's impacting our profits. They could take us to the courts, or anything like that, any change to housing policy they deem could impact their profits. Really, really concerning, considering the amount of power they have now as like the largest landlord in the state. So that was worrying. But now what now we're seeing is the Canadian investment funds have actually withdrawn a load of their investment. They've selling off their shares. And I wonder, is it because they don't see that like element of power at CETA not as much anymore, that trade agreement? Could be completely wrong. But it's just interesting to see them reducing their stake when activist investors are coming in to save the day. Don't think so, lads. Sorry about that. But just one to keep an eye on, because there's big changes happening in Irish REIT, with like board members being changed and the chair has been changed recently. Now, do I think that's going to make any difference for all of the private renters that they manage? Don't think so. But they, it is interesting to see changes, because they have such influence in housing policy in Ireland, being the biggest landlord, that it will be one to watch, I think.
Yeah, definitely. I read the same article, and then I looked up on Investopedia what is an activist investor, and the opening sentence is very indicative of what it is. An activist investor, typically a specialized hedge fund, so the hedge fund buys a significant minority stake in publicly traded company in order to change how it is run. So that's the official explanation of what they are. Unlike private equity firms that buy and restructure companies in order to profit when they are resold, activist investors seldom acquire full or majority stakes. Instead, they use public communications and private discussions to win over other shareholders and company insiders. So, like, as you say, it's definitely not the activists that we would have thought, but, or well, not that we would have thought, because obviously an activist investor is a phrase that is just being, again, co-opted to try and use a positive word, because people see activist as a positive thing, and move it into the financial sphere, into a space where they're doing the opposite of what an activist does, because activists generally tend to be looking for progress, increased living standards. You know, trade unions are full of activists who are, you know, trying to fight for better terms and conditions of employment. But this is the absolute opposite. It's trying to extract more profits for the wealthy, already wealthy, who have enough money to invest in a hedge fund. So, yeah, no, it's really interesting that they've managed to co-opt the language, and it's being facilitated by the mainstream media that these are activist investors. So very depressing. Other stories there you wanted to talk about?
Did you have any stories that you want to talk about?
Yeah, I mean, there's one in the Irish Times today as well, which is the people behind the power. I'm only going to get into it a little bit, but who are Ireland's political advisors and backroom experts? It doesn't use inverted commas for experts, but I've used them there myself just out of habit. I love this thing of how people are define themselves as experts, and the media define these guys as experts as well. You know, we're in the midst of the biggest housing crisis we've ever had. Our healthcare system is on the floor. You know, living standards are declining. Deprivation is higher now among working people than it was. 42,000 more people are experiencing poverty in work now than they were and during the economic crash. But we've got experts in their advising. So how are these guys defined as experts? Anyway, getting on to it, the first person mentioned is Brian Murphy, chief of staff to the Taoiseach, Leo Varadkar, and his job, if you read through it, is to like smooth over the relationships between the two other parties, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael. He works closely with other special advisors in there. But it was interesting when I got to the end of the article about him, the specifics about him. You know, he's on, I should mention it, he's on €185,000 as part of his salary by the state for being this brilliant expert for Leo Varadkar. It's funny, we elect someone like Leo Varadkar, who people think is the expert, and that's why they're elected, but they actually need 10, 12, 13, 14 advisors behind them to advise them on how to be a Tory, which I thought would come fairly naturally to Mr. Varadkar. But it's saying in this that, you know, he first came to prominence in 1990, when Brian Lenihan Sr. was running for the presidency against Mary Robinson, who you've already mentioned. And he asked a question on RT's Questions and Answers, which led to the downfall of Brian Lenihan Sr., asking about these the secret recordings and tapes in relation to the president, the sitting president, which I think was Patrick Hillary. Doesn't mention it here, but just from memory. Now, I don't remember that Questions and Answers. I was a bit young for it at that time. I was around, but I just wouldn't have been watching it at 8, 9, 10 years of age. But I was looking it up then, trying to find it on RTE archives, and you know, I fell into a rabbit hole of trying to find out what happened here, you know. And there's huge suspicions that Brian Murphy, Fine Gael activist at the time, was planted in the audience to ask that question to bring about the downfall of Brian Lenihan Sr. So it's really interesting that he's a special advisor 30 odd years later to the Taoiseach, and he's one of his biggest supporters. So yeah, you can go through it yourselves if you want to see who the people are. But another one that came up was Breed Murphy, a former employee of the Red Flag consultancy firm. And she's working for Fine Gael since 2012, but she was with Red Flag when they were trying to bring about the downfall of Dennis O'Brien, when he sued Red Flag for defamation for bringing about a dossier of material which was asserted as defamatory, right? So I went into Red Flag to see who they work with, you know, just to get an idea of the background of these people, because there's not many on this page. There's none on that page who are coming from an NGO trade union background who are advising the government, as you'd imagine, right? But like our experience, Red Flag Consulting has numerous clients internationally, along with a handful of local clients. Here are the countries our clients are predominantly from: the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, Afghanistan. So you can, I'm pretty sure it's not the Taliban they're advising in Afghanistan, but I could be wrong. And then they have the tokenistic European one of Germany. Like, but the, you know, what did they advise on? Financial services, engineering, real estate, power and related industries, technology, hotel, travel, everything, basically, auto, healthcare. So these are the people who are advising our government about what policies they should adopt, which I think is not an eye opener for many people on the left or the listeners to this podcast, but that's where they come up with their policies.
Yeah, but also I know a lot of people, maybe I said this on the pub before, but I know a lot of people like use the term like red flag in like a negative way, you know, like, oh god, that's a red flag, I wouldn't date him. But actually, like,
who are you
the
talking
red
about?
Flag is a similar I won't be telling my secret that is. but like, you know, the red flag is a symbol of left-wing politics. It's the communism, yeah, socialism, Marxism, like the labor movement. So like, yeah, the fact that they use it as like red flag, as in it's a negative word, is 100% anti-communist propaganda. I'm assuming that that's how that word came around. But then for them to use it in this organization as their name, bizarre. Yeah.
It's mad. But look, that's who's advising.
Being a Gale advisor, I don't. Yeah, that's red, yeah, flag. All right, if you want to put it that way, but not the communist one.
So yeah, I mean, that was one of the articles. The other one was, and just very briefly, because, you know, the whole process hasn't been completed yet, but Forces spoke the other day on the public sector pay deal. 94% of Forces members have said yes to this. It equates to approximately 10% over a 3-year period, you know, 2024, going back to January 1st, 25, 26, right? But it's staggered. So there's lots of 2.2s and 1% and stuff. And to be honest, as someone who's looked at this and negotiated around pay increases before, like, it is quite good to have intermittent 1% as opposed to a overall 10%, because a 1% on top of the previous 1% on top of the previous 1%, cumulatively, it ends up being significantly higher over a period of time. So it's an interesting one. I'm sure when this deal has been voted on, we'll come back and have a look at it in proper detail.
The ballots have to happen across all the unions to have public service members. So I think there's like 19 unions in ICTU that have members. So we'll see what way that turns out across the different unions. We'll definitely give it a bit more of an analysis then, I think. But another piece that I was reading, and like, obviously we read the papers and everything, we also read the alternative media sources as well. But the Michael Taft, who's the researcher for SIPTU, has a blog that he writes. And if anyone hasn't heard of it before, I'd recommend giving it a read. It's called Notes on the Front. And he gives a bit of commentary about this new employer organization that has popped up. So 11 employer organizations led by, you know, the Restaurants Association, Retail Excellence Ireland, ISME, have set up a new group with the name called Save Jobs. Sounds great, right? Save jobs. Employers are going to save the jobs. So essentially what it's saying that it's doing is going to represent small and medium businesses and come up, and they have a set of demands. And essentially what they want to then, the demands are, they want the state to subsidize their profit margins. And to top it off, to save all these jobs, they want to make sure that all of the lowest paid jobs' wages are frozen. So they do not want the planned increases in the minimum wage. They want that frozen to further impact inequality in the low pay sector as it is. So save jobs, but keep our profit margins is maybe what the full title of that coalition should be called. But Michael Taft goes into some of the detail of like what they're looking for, reducing VAT rates, obviously freezing wages. But what I found very interesting was actually how he gives a bit more background as to, you know, they're saying, oh, it'll save jobs, it'll save profit margins. But actually, there has been an increase in jobs in the sector as it is. So it's not that, because he's that the employers are trying to claim, oh, all these businesses are being shut down because of all the tax they have to pay. But that's not the case, because the sector is growing and more people are being employed in that sector. So, but they just don't want to pay them. They just want to keep the higher rate. So I think that's very interesting. Like, according to the Job Saves website, the increased cost of doing business will lead to a tidal wave of business closures and job losses. So Michael Taft then goes on to correct that statement and said there's absolutely no evidence that's the case at all, that employment you know, that like, if they are closing down, that you know, other things are expanding, but that he's saying it's the complete opposite, that the economy has grown by 3.5%. The But if you delve into it, so total economy is up by 3.5%, but retail and hospitality has actually gone up 6.3% and 6.8%. So it's growing faster than the rest of the economy. But yet, this employer group is saying that there's no jobs, there's no money in it. And interesting enough, the same goes for the profitability. So you're looking at the, you know, big increases in the area too. So I recommend people have more of a deep dive on that article, notes on the front from Michael Taft. But it's just an interesting, if anyone sees a lobby group called Save Jobs, they are not trying to save jobs. They're trying to save money on paying people what they're actually entitled to so that they can put more in the savings bank. So not save jobs, more in the savings bank from their profits. Complete misnomer.
Yeah, it's brilliant. Like on the website, I'm on it now and I'm looking at it, and it's the front page of it, like the homepage of the website, savejobs.ie, right? Gives you statistics, numbers, like 360,000 small businesses, 1.4 million employees. Suddenly the employers are the spokespersons for the employees. Five key issues, and then it has one economy to save. Like they're portraying themselves as some type of superhero, economic superhero who's coming in to save people. But yeah, but where I find it really interesting is that they are, you know, they made it all about jobs, as if they are the spokesperson for jobs, and that's their primary, you know, objective. But as we know, when it's in the legislation, globally, by the way, it's in the legislation under the capitalist system, is that their primary objective is to ensure there is profitability. They don't care about jobs. If any of these employers think that they'll make more profits by letting those 1.4 million employees go, they will make profit. Why do we think we see all of these employers with self-service checkout? Not because they're trying to save jobs. It's because they're outsourcing the scanning and payment of items to the customer. They get rid of jobs. These are the opposite of save jobs, these representative organizations. But no, it's a really good piece by Michael Taft. Yeah, I was having a look at it as well. And one thing that they haven't mentioned is the 2 billion. That's not a number on it, you know. How much will this cost? 2 billion euros. That's the price tag that's put on this. So what are we going to do with 2 billion lost to the exchequer this year? While, again, I've said it earlier, housing crisis, healthcare crisis, you know, everything is in crisis at the moment. And they're looking for a 2 billion tax cut for the employers, who've already, by the way, had huge tax cuts since 10 years. It's now, this is the 10th year where tax cuts have been proposed and given, mostly to the employer side of the fence. So yeah, it's really interesting thank God for Michael Taft coming out and writing this article, because, you know, it does put them in their place. It does show where, you know, their intentions are. We already know that Ireland is a hugely profitable country, and yet here they are out pretending to be the spokesperson for the employees. Save jobs, they say, but never a reference to the trade union movement, who actually had the objective, you know, of saving jobs. So, yeah. And I don't know if you have any other ones, do you? No?
No, I think that's all from my side, Dave. Is there anything you'd like to finish on?
That's all good. Covered everything, I think.
Great. We'll wrap it up then. So this has been The Week at Work. Thank you to Dave Gibney, my co-host, and I've been Michelle. And we'll be back again next week looking at the news. But make sure to give us a share in your WhatsApp groups, on your socials. We know there's lots of the podcast going around, quite a few WhatsApp groups in the last week. So we hope to keep that conversation going and give a left analysis of what's going on in the news. This has been The Week at Work, and thank you very much.